I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is the Golster Magazine Show and podcast, where, for a whole hour, we talk to fabulous and fascinating people, one of whom is with us today. My guest is a bubbly live wire of hope and optimism in a world where headlines like to draw us towards horror and gloom, homelessness, prison overcrowding, despair. She is the light that shines through the fog. A life-working charity, beginning with Mother Teresa's Home for the Dying in Calcutta, she came back to coax and lead Prince, now King Charles, and business leaders like Richard Branson deep into the inner cities so they could see exactly what is going on there. She is the founder of Key for Life, which guides thousands serving time in some of Britain's harshest prisons how to return to outside life. And here's an added twist. Much of the work she does is done with horses. And before I go too far and get anything wrong, welcome Eva Hamilton to the Golster Magazine Show.
Humphrey, thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
It's brilliant. And thanks for making it. You've had a stormy journey from Somerset, I hear.
That's right, but I'm here. So that's the main thing, yes.
Now you've spent your whole working life in charity, is that right?
That's correct. Yes, 39 years that is now. Yes, very much so.
Yes, no, you certainly don't look that old. But we'll bump around. Now, how did you start? Where was your first sort of? Is it a calling? Why did you do it?
Well, it probably was a calling. Actually, I in the early days of my career, my late teens, I found myself in Calcutta. And I had an amazing experience where I met a doctor, because I'm not one. I faint at the sight of blood. I'm not great. And he asked me, would I come into the Home for the Dying and help him, as they were short-staffed. So I was very inspired by this guy, and I went in. And I was working alongside Mother Teresa's number two. And I had spent a couple of days cleaning people, changing beds. Oh, my goodness, the bed wounds were like nothing I'd ever seen. And actually, that was what, probably a day or two after I'd finished there, I got this unbelievable kind of like something was talking to me. And the message was, I was never going to earn a lot of money on this planet, but I was here to serve. And I didn't quite know at that point what that really meant. The last 39 years have led me into all sorts of exciting things and helping others.
I mean, most of us, all of us would have heard of Mother Teresa, and she's sort of in our legend of thought. But just to give us a picture of who was she, and what exactly was this Home for the Dying like? What did it do?
Well, she was an amazing nun who had her calling from a very, very young age. And she, across the world, her order and the work she has done is very much help the voiceless, and particularly in Calcutta, which is obviously where I spent a lot of, some time. And I went back actually after she died, and we spent some time in the orphanage, her orphanage, with all these gorgeous little children. So I went from working with people who were about to cross over, also to work with little children who, you know, absolutely gorgeous, who have been abandoned. So her work and she continues to be, I feel her legacy runs through me even now, and I feel she's my kind of guiding light in a lot of what I do.
And now you're based in Britain. Is there anything equivalent in the sense of inspiration, calling, for want of a better word, in Britain to what Mother Teresa set up in Calcutta?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because actually my start of much of my work when I set up, which we'll talk in a while about, the Prince of Wales' Seeing is Believing program, I met an incredible nun called Sister Bridie, who was actually very close to Diana, the Princess of Wales. And she ran the Passage Day Centre, which you might know of in Victoria, which houses and helps some of the most vulnerable homeless people. So I worked alongside Sister Bridie. I volunteered there for a long time. So she has always been, she's Irish like me, so she and I have always had a lot in common, and I'd go and visit her and her family in Ireland, and she's been an incredible force in my life, very similar to Mother Teresa.
And these are two nuns that you've talked to, religious people. Is religion part of your life?
You know, it is. I'm not necessarily particularly religious, but I certainly believe in a higher power. I do, you know, and yes, you know, God plays a big part in what I do and how I'm directed on a daily basis. But I wouldn't say I go to church every week.
And we seem to have, I've mentioned this word calling a bit, but is it, I mean, you said you weren't here to put money, but you could have gone into the city, you could have run hotels, you could have done anything. I mean, what is it about serving, about giving, about the desperation that you see that in a way attracts you to it, or the way feel that you need to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know what, when I started my program with the Prince of Wales, I think I was in my early 20s, and I set up something called Seeing is Believing. It was entirely his idea, and he was concerned at the end of the 80s, the amount of top business leaders that were retiring and moving on, and the crucial thing was trying to hand that baton onto their successors. So I would take out top business people into the inner cities, either with the Prince of Wales or without him, or they'd report back to him. And I think for me, what was absolutely shocking was going into these inner city estates, going into homeless projects, going into inner city schools. Just for me, it was like the blinkers had been taken off, and I had never witnessed anything quite like what I was seeing in the UK in some of these really deprived communities, which you would assume in this country, we don't see what we saw. So I have to say that was what really inspired me, was after running Prince Charles's program for many, many years. That's when I went on to homelessness, which was my big love. And I felt that all of us in life can make a difference, but you've just got to get in there and find a little solution and try and pilot it and see if it works. And that's what I've always done.
So you were a teenager, early 20s in Calcutta, and you went from there to meet then Prince Charles and begin this thing. To explain how that worked.
Yeah, so that was, you know, I have to say I was quite a wayward teenager, I think my family would say, and at times was a bit rudderless. So when I had, I was very lucky that I met a woman called Dame Julia Cleverdon, and she went on to run I started the Industrial Society, and she then went on to Business of the Community. And due to my, I suppose you could say, wayward teenage years, I actually ended up having 5 lung collapses very early in my 20s, very nearly died. And I ended up having half my lung cut out. So I wasn't in a great place, but she had already hired me. And when she heard about my operation, she said, Eva, come back to the UK when you're up to it. I'd love to give you, you know, get you back into my new charity, which happened to be with Prince Charles. So I spent the first period probably recuperating, working for her, taking it easy. And then Prince Charles, he was the president of Business of the Community, came up with this brilliant idea. And I suppose right place, right time, that I was given this opportunity of setting up his Seeing is Believing program, which was what, you know, organizing all these visits for the top business leaders of Britain to go out, take them out of their ivory towers and show them what Britain's really like and what's really going on.
And I mean, you said when you went down there with Prince Charles and these people, what you saw took the blinkers off. Tell us what you saw.
So I saw, I mean, you know, we would go to places like Angel Town Housing Estate, and we would meet horrific scenes of, you know, families living in the most appalling conditions. We would meet people who there was absolutely no hope because they came from Angel Town, and that postcode in Brixton meant that they couldn't get a job. People despairing. And then we'd go up to Manchester, and into Moss Side or Crudders Park in Newcastle. And again, the same story you'd hear time and time again. And then the ones that really upset me was going to a homeless project, my first homeless project in Nottingham, where I met a lovely man who told me he had been in the military and he had served for many years and found himself on the streets. Then I met a lovely woman who was a teacher and things had gone wrong in her life and she was sleeping rough. And then I just met more and more characters that shocked me, that people, you know, it's like a table. I always describe it as four legs of a table, you know, and they say relationship breakdown is the biggest contributing factor to homelessness. And then you lose your job and then your health goes. But it's shocking to see how quickly people can lose everything. And you assume they have family, but a lot of people have walked away from their family, sadly.
You talked about your own waywardness and your lung collapses, your own ill health.
Yeah.
When you were meeting these people, was there an empathy with them? Because they were wayward, they had ill health, they had broken relationships. Did you sort of see yourself in them, the sort of composite humanity, as it were?
Yeah, no, I definitely empathized with them. And I definitely knew that life is so fragile and that I felt that given, you know, what I'd been through, I could very easily have fallen through those cracks myself. Yes, very much so.
And did the business leaders, did Prince Charles understand that as well? Did they have a similar empathy?
You know, he was incredible. Like, what I always loved about him was when we'd arrive in a place and there'd be all the business leaders there, he would always go straight to the community and talk to them first. He had unbelievable empathy with the people in the community. It was incredible to watch.
Just a thought that's come to me when you said how easily things can fall apart, because, of course, things fell apart in his family life, didn't it?
And absolutely.
What is that? And, you know, that is something we all share, however much money we've got, however much. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make such a good point. I think with all of us in life, you know, I was lucky that, you know, I had a family and I came up from a lovely family in Ireland. I've had my challenges, but, you know, you can have money, you can have a home, but actually, for me, the bit that really has tipped me over in my early 20s is due to things happening in my life, maybe I buried them, is actually the fragility around your mental health. And I feel that's probably the area that we know is so important, but too few people focus enough on, you know, their mental health. And for me, that's where I've had, you know, quite a few challenges in my early 20s and mid-20s. Around my mental health. And that I think has probably, of all the things I've experienced, been one of the most terrifying parts of my life.
Are you able, I mean, we hear mental health a lot, thank goodness. Yeah. Now, are you able to explain to us what happens when your mental health goes, when you become unhealthy? However, what the phrase is for it, what is that process? We all know what happens when you break a leg.
Yeah.
You get a cold, but what happens up here when things go?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's all different levels of mental health and when things go wrong. I think some people can just get anxiety, you worry and all of that. And I'd had all of those little things. But I think with me, when I bury things, what happened with me in my case, which was probably for me the most terrifying bit, I probably didn't see it coming, but I suddenly, I was filled with immense fear at the end of running Prince Charles's program, which I'd been running for about 6-7 years. I was clearly burning myself out, but I stopped sleeping. And that meant that when you stop sleeping, I didn't actually sleep for nearly a year. I was in a shocking state. So I started with suddenly, even the weirdest thing happened. I remember in the middle of my not sleeping. I hadn't slept at that point for about a month and I was trying to get to work. And I remember going across Putney Bridge, walking up from my home and my heel of my shoe broke. And I felt totally broken, but I wasn't showing anybody what was going on. And eventually in myself, I was having terribly negative thoughts. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't sleep. And eventually I was actually taken back to Ireland to my parents. And it did take about 4 or 5 months. I was out of work. I mean, they still very kindly kept my job open, but I was in a shocking mental state. And I was, you would say, probably very paranoid. I was imagining things, and I just felt I'd lost control of my whole life. And eventually, I was put into a psychiatric home in Dublin called St. Pat's when I was about 26, 27. And, you know, it was a horrific experience. And when I actually got to the hospital, my biggest fear was that certain people were going to come and get me. And my first night in this hospital, a woman came in at 3 a.m. and tried to strangle me. And I had, it was just one of those whole experiences I'll never forget. She then attacked my mother the same morning when she came to see me. She was another patient. And it was just, I went from bad to worse, but I was lucky I was under the greatest psychiatrist, Dr. Anthony Clare. And he was amazing and would come and see me with his team. But they never really dug away at me. But after 6 weeks, I put on about 3 or 4 stone. And eventually, the psychosis started. I suddenly started feeling a bit more normal. And then came out, my wonderful husband, as he is now, who'd stood by me through all of this, which was incredible because I kept having him thrown out of the hospital, proposed to me about 6 weeks afterwards, which my psychiatrist said, this isn't supposed to happen. But I was very lucky that he stood by me. So that was my probably most acute thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And yeah, it still fills me with dread of what happened.
And since then, you have recovered, but do you have to put in sort of building blocks to make sure you stay recovered, or was that just a...
No, you're absolutely right. I definitely have to put... But I had a kind of blip, I suppose, which I'll go on and tell you about my other charities I ran and I did homelessness. I have to be very, very, very organized, look after myself. I have to listen for the warning signs. One of the critical things is sleeping. So I always have to make sure I get enough sleep. I'm always working hard. I run, I do meditation. I keep myself in a very structured way. And also, if you think about what I'm doing now, the hours I'm working are pretty crazy and I'm in prison. So I have to keep grounded and strong. But I really feel for people out there who are suffering from mental health issues. It's not easy at all.
And not recognized either. Yeah. I mean, when you were walking along Putney Bridge and your shoe got caught, and that nobody would know.
Nobody would know.
Looking at you, what was happening. Has it improved now, or is it still very difficult to get recognized?
I think it's still very, very, I think, you know what, it's all pride. We all worry about what people think of us. And I think I don't even talk about my mental health much. Apart, I've done this interview, I've done a lot of interviews, and I don't really raise it much. But I feel it's an area that needs to be talked about more. I think, you know, there are certain people that are going to need medication, you know, to help them. But a lot of it, it's, you know, there's a cognitive, there's all sorts of therapies out there. But I think all of us as human beings are sponges. We can get very altered very quickly if you don't look after yourself. And I think if you ask how many young people who've done drugs, for example, are suffering from anxiety at the moment, there is an immense amount of young people I speak to, and they're all suffering from anxiety. And I think that comes from them maybe taking substances or doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. We're going to get onto the prison work in a minute, because that is equally fascinating. But I just want to say, and I want to say to our audience, if you've got any stories that match Eva's, any questions for anything like that, put it in the chat and we will throw it into the conversation as we always do. And particularly if you've got any mental health issues or breakdown issues or anything like that. I just wanted to, one quick is that the experience you went through in your charity work back in the UK.
Yes.
And your experience in India, how do the communities help each other? Do they help each other in different ways, or is it the same, or give us contrast?
I think India is a very interesting, the way they run their lives and the communities work together. I think they would have a much stronger community relations than we do here in the UK. I think in the communities that I work in, you get patches of wonderful communities where people work together. But I think in the main, and I can only think about where I'm sitting as we speak, is White City Estate, It was actually just quite interesting. On my way here to my office, I saw two boys just crossing and they were coming straight for me. And I thought, oh, I just don't like this feeling. And then they looked again at me and they said, are you Eva? I was on your program years ago. So it was a lesson for me. Here was I on the White City estate thinking, oh my gosh, what are they going to do? I'm on my own. But actually they ended up coming into the office and seeing the team and everything. So there you go. I should never. So that was quite amusing. But I would say in the main in London, I think it is very, very challenging. The community spirit, the youth clubs, there are so, with all these, they've cut so many of these grants, which means that these communities are really struggling. And I think when you look at young people, the provision for young people, the youth clubs and all these, they don't seem to be existing in most communities. And I think that is a huge problem.
Yes, particularly as the, and we'll get onto that in a minute, but the amount of young men that don't have fathers and that
absolutely.
Sort of thing that need that sort of youth club mentoring. But before we move on to that, give us some more descriptions. I just imagining you with Prince Charles there and then all these sort of multi-billionaire business leaders down on somewhere like the White City estate. What are they like? Men and women that sort of run these multinationals, and how do you interact with them? How do they see you?
Well, you know what? I do think that is such, it was always for me the most interesting part, because a top headhunter, her name will remain nameless, she used to say to me, Eva, I'm going to see you before you take all these CEOs in and tell me what you think of them. Some of them are unbelievable and they're gorgeous and they arrive and they're down to earth and they've obviously done really well. They're running massive companies and they really are up for the day. Others you can see are purely there because maybe it sounds terrible to say this, they want their gong or their knighthood or whatever, and they want to meet Prince Charles, but they're not really into what we're about to throw them into. So for me, the more edgy we can make it, the better. So when we go into these communities, what I've got to try and do when I'm building the visits, before they all arrive, I've got to meet the characters. I've got to bring people off the streets. And I've had many funny instances where I've brought all sorts of people off the streets who didn't turn out to be quite what I thought. But we have to build a really exciting, and it's really interesting to watch those who get on and can engage with the community and those who actually just find it all just too uncomfortable. Having left their, ivory tower, they just can't cope being in the inner cities. And I'll tell you one in particular, some are really good and I've done loads of great projects. As I say, you can't give money, you've got to give in kind after the visit, because that's the crucial thing, not just coming to look, you've got to do something. And I got a call from Ladbrokes after one of my visits to a homeless shelter in London, and he phoned me up and he said, the chief exec, Eva, I'd like to give you a building in Liverpool in it, right next door to Toxteth. So anyway, he gave me a building on the old Scotty Road, 32,000 square foot building, and I converted it with the help of loads of people into a homeless shelter and a training provision, and it was absolutely amazing. And the now king came to open it, and on the day we were still building it, but anyway, I have pictures, and it was, he really put his money where his mouth is. And another man, Lord Charles Allen, who used to run Granada, he ran a massive program, and other men, and then there were others who didn't do much, I have to say. So we had incredible people.
And one of our national treasures that everybody knows is Richard Branson. What was he like down? Because he came from a fairly sort of, he dropped out of university and everything, didn't he? Tell us how he reacted.
Yeah, well, Richard, I mean, he's incredible what he's done in the community. And you're absolutely right. He relates very well to people. And he came to the palace. I mean, he actually, to be honest, his company now, he walks his talk. He is hiring offenders, which a lot of companies aren't doing. And but he was, I think it's quite difficult for him. He first came to the palace. In the first instance, we'd invite them to Kensington Palace. The prince would set the challenge and then they'd come back. So I think he found it in a way quite difficult because he was alongside all these other chief execs. And maybe he thought, well, I don't need to be educated on this. I'm already doing it. So not that he was being arrogant, but I think there was definitely a sense of, I do this already.
Oh, I see. That's the Carolyn has asked a question, an interesting one, going back to you, actually. By working in these environments, are you able to switch off easily during your time off with family and friends?
I think that's I think my husband would probably say, Caroline, that's a great question. I think we moved out of London probably 20 years ago. And I think if I didn't have Somerset and my dogs and my horses and all of that, and that's where I switch off, then I'm ready to go and spend time with the family. But we have had quite a few prisoners, former prisoners, live with us in the early days. And that we found quite difficult. I mean, they were great, but we had one who I remember nicked one of my children's computers, so that didn't go down too well.
Yeah, and you think you're doing good, and then suddenly
somebody
refrigerator's gone. Yes,
exactly. That's a very good question, and I have to. If I wasn't in Somerset, I don't think, and my family see me in a good place when I'm and there.
Yeah, I want to move on to the prison community in a way, and I think it locks in because we're talking about mental health, we're talking about bad upbringings. We've just mentioned, 70% of people I've got down here don't have fathers. Before you tell us what you do, give us a picture of that kind of prison life. Who are these people?
So, well, they're quite a mixture. I mean, the people we work with, so when I started my prison work, I worked with 15 to 18-year-olds. So they are typically children that have got caught up in gangs and they are out there doing things they shouldn't be doing, drug dealing, they carry knives, and they've got caught up in some more serious things like joint enterprise murder. So that was the first cohort, and that's what I'll come on to in a minute. But typically in a prison now, that you get 80 to 90 year olds. I mean, we meet very old men. They're not on our program, who are very well spoken, and they're probably in there for all sorts of different reasons. And then you've got the young'uns that we call them, the 18 to 30 year olds. And they would typically be the ones who are drug dealing. They're in there for a whole raft of, maybe associated to drug dealing. So it could be knife crime, it could be burglary. And then you have the more serious ones who are in for, as I said, murder or are in for joint enterprise murder, which are the more challenging cases. The other proportion of people who do make a prison difficult to run, and those are sex offenders. So in some of the prisons I work in, they have integrated the sex offenders amongst all the other prisoners, which is not particularly easy because it's challenging. It seems to work, but it also, I think, brings its challenges. In other prisons we go to, the sex offenders are on a separate wing to everybody else.
Why are they, just to explain, maybe I'm being released to you, why is a sex offender more dangerous than a murderer or a psychotic psychopath or something?
Yeah, well, no, that's a good question. Sex offenders, the problem you have with sex offenders, in actual fact, it's quite interesting because when I'm talking to you, a lot of my men are walking in now who are all from my prison, and they would all tell you that they don't like any of them who have been involved in abusing children or anything like that. So if they think a man has done wrong to a woman, a lot of them are very, very protective of women. They can't bear it, because their mothers are usually the number one person in their life.
So sex offenders aren't necessarily dangerous to other people, but the prisoners would be dangerous to them.
Oh, yes, they'll beat the hell out of them. Yeah, and they can kill them if they get there, if there's some of them they don't like. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So which prisons do you go into? Just describe the whole, are they as bad as we hear in the press?
Well, I think I'll explain. So with Key for Life, we've worked in loads of different prisons, but I can tell you the Victorian prison. So last week we ran a program, we were just doing a bespoke program in Wormwood Scrubs. Wormwood Scrubs is a Victorian prison like Brixton and all those old ones. Wormwood Scrubs, because it's a remand prison, you've got people who are very, very unsettled. And we worked with all sorts of people. And in last week, we met all sorts of people. But the big thing in that prison is that they're going to be moved on and they're feeling very, very unsettled. So you get a lot of aggression. You've got a lot of gangs. So you've got Ladbroke Grove versus White City, for example. So they spend their life, these prisons, trying to keep people away from each other. So to run a prison is really, really tricky. Not only are you trying to run it with maybe over 1,000 men in there, you've also got all the conflict going on at the same time. The rats in Wormwood Scrubs and cockroaches, you know, they've got huge rats. It's not a particularly pleasant for the men to be living amongst that. And then you've got other prisons. So we're in Thameside at the moment, which is a remand prison. That's a modern prison next door to Belmarsh. Again, more unsettled, a lot of gang issues in there. Then you've got Forest Bank in Manchester, where we are as well. It's a local prison, so there's a lot of issues amongst the local people. And then the newest prison we're working in, which is kind of completely different because it's very modern. It's an extraordinary prison to go and visit, and that's Fosway in Leicester. That's one of the newest prisons in Britain, and we are running very big programs in there, and we bring the horses, as I'll mention in a minute.
And whether a prison's modern or Victorian, Do prisoners have got the same chance of the sort of rehabilitation you offer, or are they management structured differently?
No, I mean, they have the same chance. I mean, when you go into the modern one, you would feel a lot more comfortable there because they've got their own bedrooms, they've got a shower, you know, whereas if you go to Wormwood Scrubs, you're sharing a cell, a tiny cell with somebody else, you have a loo in there, and then you share a shower with loads of other people. So the facilities for the men, obviously, are far nicer in the modern prisons. But generally speaking, in a remand prison, there is not a lot they can do because they're waiting to be sentenced and moved on. So the crucial thing, and that's what I have my bugbear, is how we should be doing so much more about rehabilitation while you've got these people. Many of them want to better themselves, you know.
And you have an amazing statistic, which I'll let you tell us, of those who don't go through your program who reoffend and those who do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting just to so people know just how why our stats are good. But my seven-step model that I designed came off the back of all my other charities I've run. So I've done the Princess Program, then I ran a big homeless campaign, then I ran a military charity called Warrior. And then in 2011, when I saw children as young as 8 rioting, I designed a brand new model, seven-step program, and I flew to New York. And I went to meet gang leaders in Harlem and the Bronx. And I said to the gang leaders, what do you think of this model? Do you think it would work? And they all went, oh my God, bring it to America, which actually, ironically, I went to New York 2 weeks ago because the Americans do want to bring Key for Life to America. But when I went, I flew to Bristol with my model. And I brought lots of military trainers in. This is when I started Key for Life. And the minute we went into the prison, the 15 to 18-year-olds showed us absolutely no respect. And they didn't even want us in the prison. And I was like, and my trainers that I'd brought in with me were like, Eva, you've pitched this wrong. We want to get out. And I'm like, no, don't get out. Wait for the horses to arrive. So 10 minutes later, we brought these 2 mares in, 2 female horses, and they went absolutely ballistic in the prison. The horses wanted to get out. They didn't want to stick around. But the same men or children, they're all 15 to 18-year-olds, they were so scared when they saw the horses. They all hid under their chairs in the gym, and they refused to come out. And eventually we got them out, and they worked with the horses. It was the most incredible thing to watch. So we suddenly realized we had something more powerful than them. And then that night, I brought in the music industry, a guy called Darkest Beast, who used to run Island Records. And he came in, met our men, and we had another 24 children who were all in tragically for murder, and they were only 14, 15-year-olds. And he had the same problem. He had, for about 6 minutes, no one would talk to him. He was managing Amy Winehouse at the time. He was managing loads of artists. And he waited 6 minutes. And then he eventually said, does anyone know an artist called Angel from Shepherd's Bush. And the minute he mentioned Angel, everyone went, "Ah, we all know Angel." And when he walked out, he said, "Eva, never again will I ever, ever, ever do anything for you, but get Angel down here." So 2 weeks later, we had a big Black Mariah turn up with Angel. And we had a guy called Dave, a famous rapper's manager, Ben Scar. And they got out, came into the prison, and honestly, they wowed the men. And they spotted a couple of my guys, and one is actually still working for me, and said, "He's one of the best rappers we've ever heard and seen. We want to do an album with them." And that was the start of Key for Life. And that was the very, very first program. And I'm still in touch. And I've got quite a few of them. I haven't yet come out of prison because they've been in long sentences. And I'm working with three of them at Fosway, who were on my first ever program 12 years ago. But they've yet to come out. So
what an incredible story. I have got so many things I want to pick up on that, but I got to pick up on the horses. Now, they reacted to the horses, not because they were afraid of the horses, but because there was some other thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was some of them were partly fear, but it's also with us as humans. And funny enough, the reason the horses, I introduced the horses in 2011, when I had my blip, the only time I felt comfortable was when I went out to see my horses. They wouldn't let me ride them, but something made me feel more calm. And that's when I went and did research, and I saw in America that they do a lot of this horse therapy. So in the middle of our brain is something called the limbic part of the brain, and the horse has the same in their brain. So they resonate on a completely amazing level with a human being, and they can suss us out. And they immediately can see what's going on with human beings. It's amazing.
So I need to picture this, because when I look at a prison, I sort of see these sort of wire things and little cells and that. Where do the horses, how do you actually get them in there?
Oh my God, and I have my two horses. So I have a horse who's 18 years old. He's huge. If any of you want to look up a film called ID Magazine, you'll see him at Key for Life. He's my gray. I bred him. Very, very nice on the ground, but very excitable when you ride him. But the other horse, so they both come out of famous stallion fathers. His father made our cousin 6.5, you know, a lot of money, basically. And the other one kicks and bites. So when we bring them in, we get a horse box. They've just been in Manchester a few weeks ago. And we bring them up and we'll overnight them somewhere. And then we bring them in a horse box. And as you can imagine, the security, oh my gosh, they get so stressed because they have to go through the whole horse box to make sure we're not bringing anything in. And particularly when we leave, they have to make sure no one's trying to get out. Yeah. But most importantly, when we bring them in, the horses are let free and you should see them. They work with the men. So we do a bit of work on boundaries to begin with. And then eventually they'll do a lot of work getting to know the horses. And then we blindfold the men and they have to do an obstacle course with six guys. The blindfolded guy will lead the horse. It's amazing to watch. And the other guys will support him. And he has to identify what is stopping him in his life from getting the life he wants.
Grief.
So all sorts. And then we tie, when they leave the prison, the horses, all the men tie a message in the horse's mane of what do they want to let go of on one side of the ribbon, and on the other side, what do they want more of? And the horses take out their messages out, you know, and gallop off with them, and we let them go.
Okay. Just go back to this limbic part of the wood.
Yeah.
What is it? That's a sort of calming and
Yeah, we resonate. So both of our brains, the horse's brain and a human's brain, they resonate on our level. So they can really understand without you or I saying anything, doing anything. They've sussed us out immediately. But we can also pick up the fear. They pick up our feelings and the horses, and you will pick up what the horse is feeling as well.
And this is more than a cat or a dog.
Much more so. Yeah, horses for some reason are, I mean, cats and dogs play a brilliant role as well. But I also think the power of a horse is also amazing.
It's so big. Wonderful big. And I'm going to come back to the horse, but there's another question that's jangling in my mind. When you went over to New York and you talked to these gaffigists, right?
Now, yeah.
Wouldn't it be in the interest of the gang leaders to keep their members in the gangs, not to have them reform to be good citizens?
Well, that I think you make a very good point. Some of these were reformed gang leaders.
Oh, okay.
I think we deal with a lot of gang leaders here, and you are right. If you can show them there's another way to live and that there's a more, and it could be more lucrative as well. Don't forget, these guys are looking over their shoulders the whole time when they're doing things they shouldn't be doing, you know. And in America, you know, they have, when I was out there, I was horrified because I met a lot of people who were in prison who just come out after 60 years. I mean, their prison sentences are really long as well, much longer than ours.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, this whole thing that I'm sort of putting together, the closing of the grants that you saw in the inner cities, the lack of the mentors, because there are these broken families and a lot of these guys, young men, don't have father figures, and then a lot of them naturally end up in prison.
That's correct.
And then we talked earlier about mental health, so there would be a predominance of mental health issues amongst them as well.
Yeah, I mean, you make such a good point about the father. It's so shocking. I mean, one of my cohorts recently, because we do all the research on all of the different cohorts, 78% didn't have a father.
78%?
Well, 78 don't have a father growing up.
Yeah.
70% is the average of our cohorts. In right. terms of mental health, we would have about 30% who would have mental health issues. But I think when you go into prison, if you've never been away from your family before and stuff, it can, you know, it's quite dangerous. In you know, it's not an easy place to be for a lot of people. And, you know, we find a lot of them are suffering from anxiety. But it's amazing when you start helping turn their life around and you show them a new way. I mean, you would be amazed at our results. And I'm dealing with, so the men we work with are prolific offenders, right? So our guys have an average of 7 offences. And some of them have up to 100 offences. So I'm dealing, and we've got our graduation this afternoon. I mean, I've got a guy here at the moment who's just, I've just been talking.
Are you in a prison at the moment?
No, I'm in our office, but we have our graduation this afternoon. So I've got one guy who used to play for Arsenal. He's just come out of prison, and he's here at the moment. I've got another guy, and they've just done a film about him from Germany, the equivalent of the BBC, super guy. And I've had another one just walk in, said, we're having our graduation, and all of them will graduate. And we also train lots of them up to become key mentors. So they then help us in prisons, and they get an AQA qualification. And that's, they are the army, that they are the people who are the change makers, are the people. So a lot of our staff, the people I employ, are all people who've been to prison, quite okay. a lot of them.
And you say they graduate, so then do they have jobs to go to? Not just
that's what we're people. Helping them with at the moment. Some will have jobs. So one of my guys here today, the guy who used to work for Arsenal, he's going on a work taster tomorrow. So what we try and do is put them. So our model is all about unlocking their pain. So we use horses, music, and football. We bring QPR in, and that's the first stage. Then, as you rightly pointed out, they don't have role models. So our second part of in the prison, this is all pre-release, we bring in loads of business people and they end up being their mentors. So there's an ex-director of a huge movie company just here at the moment. He's mentoring the guy who used to play for Arsenal, and they're sitting down making an action plan. Then the next thing we do is we do employability. So we work with big companies like KPMG, NBC, Universal, lots of them, and they then help us in the prison with CV preparation, mock interviews, get the guys ready for work. And then the last week, we do loads of tools as well, lots of role playing and temptation and spider's web, like who's your network at the moment? Because you have to make sure they're not going to come out of prison and go straight back to their old friends, because a lot of their friends will be up to no good.
I remember when they had that early release thing a few months back, and the press carried a couple of pictures outside of one of the prisons of people being met by people in Lamborghinis and Mercedes stretches. And presumably these were the gang members sort of picking them up and taking them back in or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, we saw that last week, even when we were up there. I saw a guy being collected in that probably, I hadn't even seen cars like this. They must have been worth, and I did ask them all what they did for a living. And they all very quickly told me their companies they ran. But I mean, I couldn't quite believe the amount of money. But we do, the last week in the prison, we do the Dragon's Den, and they love that. So a lot of them are great entrepreneurs, and we have guys setting up companies, and they love that. And then the last bit we do is we bring loads of companies in. So we will bring about 25 companies into prisons, and we put our men in shirts and ties. So most of them have never worn a shirt and tie before, and we're trying to change their look. Mm-hmm. And then the companies, after that, before they come out of prison, will say, I'll take him on a placement. So the minute they come out of prison, we're at the gates to collect them. We go in and see them before they come out. But the critical thing is, the minute they hit that road, you've got to be careful that they're not going to get back to their old ways. So we get them suited and booted into a suit, 3-day work taster, and we do lots of activities. So our ultimate goal is trying to get them into work.
Okay, so there's a critical time, I presume. They walk out of the prison. I mean, you're actually in a critical 24-hour period, are you, where they could go one way or the other?
Oh, my God, totally. And that's the role play. One of the role plays we do is, imagine you come out of prison, your mother's there to collect you, you haven't seen her for ages, and then a car pulls up, a Mercedes with all your co-defendants in it. Who are you going to go with? So that's one example we give them. Another one we do is, you've started work, it's your first week, and one of your co-defendants turns up at your work and offers you £5,000 to move a parcel. What are you going to do? You're going to stay at work, or you're going to go and move the parcel? And then we do another really interesting exercise around, would you take 50,000 dirty money or 20,000 clean money? So we have big disputes, and that really creates, as you can imagine, all sorts of interesting insights.
And then give us an idea of the conversations that, you know, you put these scenarios forward. How sophisticated are the arguments and conversations?
Oh my God, so sophisticated. You can't even, I mean, these guys are so wise. Like, you would not believe what they come out with, and their rationale for doing what they do. It's unbelievable. But we will convince them eventually that 20,000, most of them will go for the 20,000 clean.
Yeah.
But some of them don't quite understand that 50,000 dirty, what it'll bring.
We've touched the genesis of the broken home and everything, but the recruitment into the gangs, and we so much knife crime, and we see these people that have murdered people age 15. Give us a pen picture of that society.
I mean, it's you have to understand they're in tribes. It's very tribal how they all operate. And the problem you've got is, none of these men in the past will leave their home without a knife, right? Because they've got people after them, right? So they're going to have a weapon on them. If you hear my staff in the park, they don't carry weapons now, but they would say they would never have left their home without a weapon on them. What's alarming is how it's gone from guns to now, lots of them are knives to guns. Guns is the big thing now. A lot of them are getting caught up in. So the gang members, I've got a couple of guys who've been with me for years, and they're now, they've been in prison. I met them in prison. I've got one of them is now in a big investment bank. Another few of them are in insurance in the city. They will all tell you that it starts with sweets. So when you're 8 years old, your dad's not around, but there might be some bloke that offers you sweets at 8 years old and starts grooming you from that young age. By 11, he's asking you to move drugs and sell drugs. So you've got to understand that a lot of these kids, when the mum has got no money, there's no electricity, there's no food, they've got 4 or 5 siblings, that it's incredible how quick they get caught up in this underworld.
And then the knife, the actual, when they're sent out to kill somebody,
Well, the killing is usually one thing. I don't think they necessarily, well, some of them, yeah, obviously you hear horrific things that they've killed somebody. But a lot of them, they use the knife to scare the person. But rival gangs, I mean, the guys who I've worked with, a number of my guys are in, joint enterprise murder. So they weren't there for the murder, but because they were part of the gang, the whole lot got done for murder.
And how structured are the gangs? I mean, you talk about some of these people going into this city, having these great entrepreneurial ideas. Are the gangs run like small companies?
They are. You're absolutely right. I mean, you would be so surprised about how these drugs, it's all about money. and it's about how they run. They'll have a marketing person. It's like HR. If you got them to pitch to you, if you were a dragon in the prison and they came up with proper business concept, you'd be blown away by their knowledge of running companies. And that comes sadly from running big drug cartels.
And you mentioned the Y City gang, as they the Shepherd's Bush gang, two areas in West London. And how many people would be in them?
Oh, there's quite a lot of people in them, and there's a lot of different gangs. It wouldn't just be White City. There'd be a number of gangs within White City.
Sort of sub gangs within gangs.
Lots of, culturally, you'd have a lot of the Asian boys. Then you'd have a lot of the, you know, you get a lot of the Afro-Caribbean. You know, they're in different groups as well.
And the work that you do. It touches on, I guess, a small percentage of the prison population. Absolutely. How many other groups like you, and presumably there are other charities that do that, and how many people get a proper rehabilitation program, and how many are just flung out onto the street on release?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest issue is there's lots of great charities doing brilliant things. The bit that's missing is the through the gate, because you can do great things in prisons, but what you've got to make sure is that there is support when they come out of prison. So I think when you ask the question, probation obviously are struggling at the moment. They essentially are in charge of these people when they leave prison. I would say the biggest challenge we have at the moment, and this is something, it's my real, you know, bete noire at the moment, I want to see a lot more people, you know, really helping. Companies in Britain need to be doing a lot more of coming into prisons, training up people before they leave prison, and opening up job opportunities, because so many people are being discriminated against just because of the fact they've been to prison. And a lot of companies in Britain are just tick boxing, and they're not stepping up and offering people another chance. So I would say, when you say how many come out, I would say a very large proportion come out with very, very little support on the out. And they might have had some support inside, but it's when they're in the community, it's the jobs, it's that's critical to get them to change their lifestyle.
So would it be feasible or legislated for or something that if you run a company of X size, a Tesco or a Sainsbury's or BP or something like that, you have to take in or you have to get involved in this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it should be. I think all corporates, I think in Britain, we have so many disenfranchised people who are excluded, that we all have a responsibility as society to get more, as you've just said, companies in Britain to offer a proportion of their jobs to people who are, you know, have been excluded from society.
We have a couple of questions before we go to the promos. Emma says, you are an amazing lady who has done what seems to be impossible to most people, a very special human being. And she asks further, do you have to take precautions for fear of being attacked by gang bosses who want to take revenge for you stopping their business?
Yeah, do you know, that's a really good question. Do you know what? Not till now, no. But I'm very lucky, I think, that a lot of people surround me with, you know, we've got a lot of my team members are former offenders. So if there's any concerns I have, it would be them that I would talk to.
Because they will be able to sense it.
They'd be able to sense it.
They're your radar.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bigger issue is having people work for me who maybe, you know, things haven't worked out and they maybe the job wasn't what they thought it was and we've had to let people go. Then, you know, I've definitely had people who don't like me because we've hired them in the past and it hasn't worked out here. You know, it's a very tough job, this. This is not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah. And how many sort of in the past, say, 5 years have been through your system? Are we talking hundreds, thousands, tens?
No, we're just over the last, since we started, we're over 1,000, and we've had about 7,000 children we've worked with as well. So we run at-risk programs in the community and we run prisons. And I think you mentioned earlier about what our results were. And I think our reoffending rate last year was 7%, and the government's for our prolific offenders is 64%. And then into training and employment, our statistic last year was 65% and the government is 15%. And so we've done, I think, you know, pretty well. I think if they come on Key for Life, they're four times less likely to reoffend and four times more likely to be.
And they've got a, I'm actually going to put, it was in there before, but I'm going to re-put in the chat your website so that everybody can go to it and see what you do. We have some more comments coming in. Josie Morgan, always go to Timpson's for cobbling. Timpson's, he's now the minister of
prisons. He's now the minister of prisons. That's exactly right. Yeah, Timpson, you're absolutely right. Well done, you, for support. He has all of his staff are offenders, which is amazing.
Yes. Do you know him? Do you work
with him? I do. I've met him. Actually, I wrote to him recently and he said he wants to come and see Key for Life now with his new role. So probably a long list of things we want him to help us with.
That's pretty well. He's at the heart of government. So Caroline, who had a comment before, it's wonderful work you're doing, as some people just need that help, guidance and advice, which may have been lacking from their lives before. That just about sums it up for a lot of people, isn't it? Not natural criminals, but, you know, dragged into a way of life. So just sit there, Eva, for a moment whilst I tell our wonderful people that on December the 17th, that is a week from now, I am with the sporting supremo, Mihir Bose, who's a journalist and writer. He's Reflections on Migration, Race, British Society since the 1960s. And as a journalist, he made history as being the BBC's first non-white editor. December the 23rd is Christmas Eve. We have no show, but if you want one, just drop us a line and we might put something on. December 31st is New Year's Eve. Lucinda has on her party dress for Claire McIntosh's The Last Party, a village murder mystery that takes place, yes, you might have guessed, on New Year's Eve. And January the 7th, I'm with Kim Leng Ling, all the way from Pennsylvania, who is an expert in how the transformative power of kindness and how pets make us better people. We'll want to hear your pet and kindness stories from that. That's a thought, isn't it? Kindness, generosity makes people not want to be nasty. Any thoughts on that, Eva?
Well, I think I love pets. They're my bestest friends, horses, dogs, cat. I love all my animals. And they make me kinder, I think, as well.
Yeah. And as you see these sort of gang kids being transformed and getting, they put their sort of what they want on the horse's manes and it goes out. Do you see a new generosity, a sort of empathy or whatever coming, the character transformation?
Definitely. Honestly, if you were at the prison at last week when we did our graduation at Fosway, we had 50 prisoners and we had 20 people we trained up. They were all up there speaking to the prisoners, all about, and they're all prisoners themselves, what Key for Life had done and what the training had done and what they now wanted to do to give back to others. It was just, honestly, remarkable.
And
they are wonderful, unsung heroes, all of them.
And thinking of how we began with you as a teenager, early 20s, Mother Teresa going through those troubles in your mid-20s, and you just told that story now. How does that make you feel?
You know, it makes me feel very humbled that I'm even in this position. I feel very, very blessed.
Yeah. And give us a final thought, sort of encapsulating the world that you know so well, that you've explained so brilliantly to us. What we can all do or how we should be involved?
Well, I think one of the greatest things is these people, I think it's the underdog in life, really focus on giving these people another chance. So if you're able to just share even the stories of what we do with the horses, our model, we need your help to ask more companies out there and politicians, you know, what are they doing to help people? Because I think if we all do our bit, it's amazing how we could change the whole rhetoric and the whole story around, you know, offenders and, you know, people who've been kicked out of society, but they deserve another chance. So we need everyone to help us with that.
Right. You've said that the next time I meet a CEO of a corporation, I'm going to say, what are you doing?
Absolutely.
And of course, if you manage to to stop the reoffending, everything becomes safer in our lives, doesn't it?
Totally. The communities are safer and they then start contributing to our economy. And that's what so many of them are doing now. They're contributing, they're paying their taxes and they're doing their bit. So, yeah, it's...
A final thought from Emma before we have to go. It would benefit society if you also worked with high school children for them to know the statistics of pointing out how the lack of male role models can affect them. High school children, is that a place to work and to educate people, Eva?
No, you're absolutely right. We have done a lot of work with children and we've gone into schools and we've worked with kids who've been excluded, who are in PRUs. It's just at the moment our focus, because the need is so great in prisons, we're just hoping that Keep Alive, particularly the army of men we're building up now, I'm hoping that we can start really expanding this model across the criminal justice sector and the prison estate. I think there is a massive gap at the moment. So we have to focus, but you're absolutely right. Children are what we also do, but my trustees are pushing me very much down the road of the focus needs to be prisons at the moment. Day we will forget about children.
That's excellent. It's the younger generation and all that. What a wonderful hour we have had. We are out of time. Thank you, Eva, for guiding us through that world.
Thank you, and happy Christmas, and thank you for having me on your show. I really enjoyed it, and thank you to all the people that came to listen as well. That's very kind of them all.
That is brilliant. Until next week with Mihir Bose, stay curious, keep active, be generous, think of our prisons and how to get people out of them, and the younger generation, love our animals as we're going to talk, and our horses. Stay Goldster. Check out our podcasts of past guests just by googling Goldster podcasts. Eva will be up there soon, and an array of beautiful conversations will unfold in front of you. What incredible, inspiring guests you've been, Eva. Thanks so much.
So much. Bless you. Thank you very much for having me.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.